Hello, hello, hello. My name is Jill Cody, and welcome to Be Bold America. Be Bold America is a live, bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to begin reuniting this country, understanding the challenges ahead, and learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to save our democracy. Our future depends on it. Our program today is Protecting Democracy, and after the historical week we just experienced, I am really looking forward to speaking to our guests from Protect Democracy, that is, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with the urgent mission to prevent our democracy from declining into a more authoritarian form of government. We have big things to do. On the phone with us today is the legal counsel for Protect Democracy, Ben Berwick. Before joining Protect Democracy, Ben worked for 6.5 years in the U.S. Department of Justice, spending most of his time as a trial attorney with the Civil Division, Federal Programs Branch. In that capacity, Ben defended against challenges to the federal statutes and actions of the executive branch. He litigated cases involving a variety of statutes and agencies, including as the lead attorney in cases challenging the Department of Education and the DOJ's interpretation of Title IX as prohibiting discrimination against transgender students. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you, Jill. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
It is a pleasure to be with you, too. And my in-studio guest is on his way, so I will introduce him when he arrives. So I know we have a lot to talk about, and before we get talking about Protect Democracy's mission and what you're combating right now, I've really been looking forward to speaking with you for many reasons, but before we get to anything else, I have to ask you your thoughts on the historic week we've just had.
Yeah, it's been quite a week, and every week feels like quite a week these days. But I this one sort of takes the cake so far. It's really been astonishing. I mean, what has come to light this week is that the president has used the power of the presidency to pressure a foreign government to interfere in our elections. It is a jaw-dropping abuse of power. I think everyone who hasn't should read what is being called the transcript of the president's call with the president of Ukraine, although it is not really a transcript. It's sort of a memo summarizing the call, as well as the whistleblower's complaint that brought this to light. It is clear from those documents that this was basically a shakedown, that the president was using the enormous foreign policy power that he has to shake down another country in order to get them to help him win the 2020 election, to investigate a political rival. And again, that is just a shocking abuse of power. And I think it's critical to understand the context in which this takes place. It's not abusing the foreign policy power is bad enough, but the president did it in order to manipulate an election. And that, I think, is maybe the most disturbing aspect of this. I mean, we've heard people say before, let the voters decide. But that argument sort of loses all of its power when what the president is doing is trying to manipulate or interfere with a free and fair election. And my organization, Protect Democracy, which I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about, has actually put out a white paper that you can find at our website, protectdemocracy.org, about the danger of elected officials manipulating or interfering in an election and how Congress might take some steps to make that at least more difficult, if not stop it from happening altogether.
Well, you're absolutely right how stunning this is. Jaw-dropping, breathtaking. It's just not the enormous foreign policy power he has. It's the position power in the world. I mean, we talk about the American president being the most powerful man on earth, and yet he's doing this as his for manipulating an election that is coming up. And now I have my guest in the studio, and let me introduce you to Mike Rotkin. Mike Rotkin is a former five-time mayor of the city of Santa Cruz and served six terms on the Santa Cruz City Council between 1979 and 2010. Mike retired after teaching 42 years in the Community Services Department at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where he served as director of the Field Studies Program, supervising student interns working on social and environmental issues in Santa Cruz around the globe. Welcome, Mike. Welcome back. It's very nice to have you in the studio.
Glad to be here. Sorry I'm a bit late.
That's quite all right. We're just glad to have you here. Thank you.
You know, on the last point that we were just talking about, I think equally important with the idea that he basically trying to sort of use foreign powers to try and influence our local elections, which is absolutely horrible and critical, is the idea that he was going to basically withhold money that had been appropriated by Congress and through the normal process of our Constitution. And that's what he was basically threatening to withhold if he didn't get what he wanted from this person. It wasn't just, hey, please do me a favor. It's like, if you don't do me a favor, I'm going to withhold money that the United States has promised to your government to protect itself. And of course, it's not an accident that it might be to protect itself against Russia, a good friend of Donald Trump. So, I mean, both sides of this equation are just horrible.
Well, I also want to trade you white papers, Ben, because we do want people to, our listeners, to go to your website, protectdemocracy.org, for your white paper on this very subject. I have on my website, jillcodyauthor.com, a white paper on the dark triad personality. And people have often mentioned how Donald Trump is a narcissist or even a psychopath. But in my view, I think he's even worse than that, because a dark triad personality, the character traits they have are a combination of narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. So these types, personality types, although rare, they can damage just about anything with which they come in contact. Relationships, families, workplace, organizations. So I just think that we even need to be more prepared for the future of what a dark triad personality type who holds the most powerful position in the country can come up with in the future. So I just wanted to trade white paper.
Good idea.
I'm always happy to trade white papers.
go ahead, Ben.
No, I was just going to, Jill, I was going to pick up something on Mike said, which I think is absolutely right. There are just so many different angles to this and so many reasons why it is such an abuse of power. I mean, as Mike said, Congress has given her the power of the purse. They allocated aid money to Ukraine, and the president basically held that aid money hostage for his own purposes. On top of that, you know, he may have committed a felony by violating campaign finance law. And then you have the cover-up here, which is that it seems that people in the White House knew how troubling this conversation was, and took pains to hide the transcript in a system that is really supposed to be used for highly, highly classified information. According to the whistleblower, this is not the first time that this system has been used. And I think according to reporting, this is not the first time the system has been used to hide transcripts of the president's calls with foreign leaders.
You know,
which is another extremely disturbing aspect of it.
Just to get a sense of the scale of this, I have friends on the left who, you know, very quick to call Donald Trump a fascist, and then we're moving to fascism. And they've been, not even before Trump, you know, our country's got various problems in terms of the undermining of real democracy. But the idea that people should understand that Adolf Hitler was elected to office. He didn't, like, you know, this. He didn't come to power in a coup. He was elected in a democratic process in a country with full democratic rights and a structure very, you know, not the same as ours, but an open democratic structure. And it was by little things like are starting to happen now that Hitler began to take power. And as I say, I resisted the temptation to sort of think about parallels with Nazi Germany. But this is where we're going. When the President of the United States no longer feels bound in any way by the Constitution and looks after his own personal power and those questions. And it's not even personal power for, let's say, a wrong-headed public policy. It's self-interest. And we're talking about things that will help him personally. And his whole White House has been about how his own properties and his own the tax return issue is not a small question. You know, just people might be curious what the person has investments in. But here's a president who's running this country on the basis of can he get guests at Mar-a-Lago? Can he you know, get investments in new hotels in places throughout the world? The stuff in Russia seems to be, I mean, again, we don't have the deep detail on it, but it sure seems to be like what he's involved in there is not some strange policy in relation to Russia that has to do with a wrong-headed idea about what our foreign policy should be towards that country, but what can he do for his own personal property interests in Russia? And that's the kind of thing that, as I said, the parallel with Hitler is not an exaggeration at this point. We're on the road to that kind of, you know, loss of complete democracy in our society if this goes on punished. And that's why I think the Democrats' decision to invoke or begin the process of the impeachment was absolutely necessary. I shared Nancy Pelosi's sense of we don't want to do this too early. People don't necessarily understand what's going on, but we're at the point now where we need to do something about this, and it cannot pass quietly. Even if the Senate's not going to, you know, vote for impeachment, to call this out and to say this is enough, we're drawing a line somewhere against this kind of behavior is really kind of critical. And the stuff of yours that I've read, Ben, you know, suggests how critically important it is that we catch these kinds of things early and deal with them and not wait till it's too late.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I am, you know, always, I think for obvious reasons, a little uncomfortable with drawing parallels to Nazi Germany.
Sure.
I don't think you quite have to go that far because, you know, we have seen democratic decline around the world, particularly in this century, in countries like Hungary and Poland and Turkey and Venezuela and now the United States. And these are not the dramatic decline of democracies that we saw around World War II when fascist governments came into power through, or even post-World War II in the 1980s when governments would come into power by coup or by military overthrow. These are much more subtle and sort of slow declines where someone comes into power through democratic means and then slowly undermines and erodes the institutions and rule of law in those countries that have made those countries democracies. And, you know, you look up after a few years and it's not a democracy anymore. And that's really what we're trying to prevent in this country, because there's no doubt that this president, whether by design or just instinct, is following that playbook that we've seen in other former democracies, now autocracies around the world.
I think you're right about that, Ben. I wasn't trying to draw, you know, that we are now living in, you know, like Nazi Germany, or that in any way that that's the case. But it's just, I was just looking back on that. And I've spent quite a bit of time sort of trying to understand the history of fascism and how it also began quite slowly at the beginning, just, you know, basically violation of various kinds of court orders where the government ignored orders from the courts and then began to ignore legislative mandates that were required by the Weimar Republic in Germany. And to see them, these early stages of it just makes me nervous, is what I'm suggesting. I think your analysis of the, you know, not trying to draw an exact parallel is absolutely correct.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide, online at ksqd.org, and you may also email the station at info@ksqd.org.
Hello, Santa Cruz. This is Ralph Nader. Start your week off right by listening to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour every Monday morning at 9 a.m. right here on KSQD. Every week we bring you the guests that don't get the exposure and the issues that don't get discussed nearly enough on commercial radio. That's every Monday morning, 9 a.m. right here on KSQD.
You're listening to K-Squid, Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM. Many voices, community radio.
Today my guests are Ben Berwick, Protect Democracy's counsel, and Mike Rodkin, five-time mayor of the city of Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Well, just to pick up where we left off, discussing about how easily we can just slip into an authoritarian state. In the book, How Democracies Die, Stephen Left, I guess it's Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, they just talked about the guardrails of democracy can slowly be torn down in the institutions meant to serve the public and become a tool of the ruling party instead. Isn't this exactly what McConnell and Trump are doing, Ben?
Yeah, I think that's right. What we're seeing is a slow erosion of the institutions and guardrails of our democracy. And we at Protect Democracy believe that the really critical thing to do now, particularly when Trump is out of office, is to enact some really broad reform to fix some of the vulnerabilities that he has exposed. I mean, I think we should be absolutely clear. Trump is a symptom of a longer-term weakening of American democracy. He is obviously an acute system and one that must be dealt with. But the problems that we're facing now predate the president and won't go away when he's gone. And he has really served to expose some of the weaknesses and vulnerabilities in our democracy that might not have been so obvious. And the thing that really keeps me up at night is that there is someone out there watching Trump and watching his undermining of American democracy and saying, you know what, I can do that, but I can do it much better than him. And I think there's going to be a moment once Trump is out of office, once he's gone, where the country may be ready to reckon with the damage that he has done and make sure that it doesn't happen again, sort of like the reforms after Watergate.
Right,
and
that's a good parallel.
It's critical that we seize that moment, and Protect Democracy has a number of legislative proposals that will help close some of the gaps and loopholes that the president has exposed.
Well, Ben, let's go to Protect Democracy's mission and goals right now, because we haven't had a chance to talk about that some more. What are you currently combating? Tell us a little bit more of the key things you're working on.
Yeah, so when Protect Democracy was founded shortly after the election, we talked to a lot of experts around the world who are experts in democratic decline, democracy and democratic decline. And those experts sort of universally identified six red flags for democratic decline. Think of these as sort of the patterns of behavior that are common to aspiring dictators and autocrats around the world, what we sometimes refer to as the autocrats' playbook. And those six buckets, which I'm happy to talk about at greater length, are delegitimizing communities. This is marginalized communities in particular, politicizing independent institutions, executive power grabs, spreading disinformation, quashing dissent, and is particularly relevant to this week, corrupting elections. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand that, you know, when you really step back and look at Trump's behavior, they actually fit quite neatly into these six categories. Almost everything he does fits into this framework. And I think it can help to keep, it really helps keep this framework in mind. Because once you sort of have it in mind and are thinking about it, it's you start to really see patterns. And I know the news and everything that Trump does can be totally overwhelming, but you start to be able to sort of see how everything that Trump does fits into this sort of autocratic pattern. So those are the issues that we're really working on, and you know, all of our work falls into one or more of those buckets, those categories of autocratic behavior.
Well, let me also add to the autocratic behavior. When I talk about Machiavellianism and that dark triad personality, Maybe people don't understand what that means, because Niccolo Machiavelli, after he was banished from political life, he wrote his most famous work, The Prince. And in that, he advocated that rulers, and I think Trump thinks of himself that way, that rulers be unscrupulous and resort to deceit, cunning, political assassination. And we know that Trump entertains verbal political assassination all the time, and the use of fear to keep order and to stay in power. So you've got authoritarian personality with that kind of Machiavellian traits inside. It's very frightening. Mike, did you have something? No. So, you know, I think what you're talking about, those six buckets are really strategic.
One of the buckets, and I'm not starting in the right order probably, but the sort of growth of executive power, it's something that started pretty early in our country. Up until Herbert Hoover was president, the Congress actually used to make the budget. Following that, that was the first time that we began to see presidents actually, you know, publish a budget, which then Congress took under advisement. And then, of course, the bills start in the House. But the idea that the executive branch will determine, you know, set out the sort of vision of where we're going with our budget, that's not something that was in any way understood by the founding fathers. They really wanted to sort of see budgets created at the most grassroots level in the House of Representatives, and which is the most representative legislative of all the branches of our government. And so it started there, and only very slowly did power accrete to the executive branch. But as you pointed out earlier, Ben, in recent years, it's been really accelerating how much the executive branch has been taking over various kinds of functions that used to be thought of as something that Congress had control over and was supposed to be involved in. So there's a situation now where I don't know how this happened, but I stumbled onto Fox News for a couple minutes two nights ago, and Rudy Giuliani was on being interviewed by somebody. This was late at night, and they're just talking about, well, what's wrong with the president having the power to do these things? We need, it's sort of this kind of authoritarianism. We need to have somebody that's sort of in charge. Things don't work well if somebody's not in charge. And of course, the Fox News correspondent's like nodding her head and thinks this is all great. And they go on and on about it, and they say, well, what's wrong with the president making a deal with somebody that, you know, that's what presidents get to do, that they got elected president. And they go on and on with no reference back to the structure of our actual government and democracy. And so it's been, as I said, a growing problem from fairly early on. We're talking now well over 100 years that we've had this sort of move towards executive power. But it really has been accelerating in recent years. And the war powers is some of the most important ones. One thing, thankfully, about Trump, he doesn't appear to be looking for a war, but if you, as you were saying earlier, somebody that follows his footsteps might be thinking that's exactly what they should do, and that, of course, would help with a re-election campaign to be in the middle of a war when people don't want to change horses in the middle of a big struggle or something. And so the situation where the president, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which follows just the fact that we just found ourselves in the Vietnam War without any real declaration of war. How many other wars have we been involved in where Congress has really never voted to have that war in some way at all, or voted for it only after the fact when we already have American soldiers at risk and people don't want to vote against the military under those conditions? But the idea that people did not want the president of the United States to be able to declare war. And in fact, we now have a situation where the executive branch decides if we get in wars, not the Congress, not the people of the United States.
Ben?
Yeah, I think, Mike, you're absolutely right that the story of the last maybe 100 years, but at least sort of recent decades, is the flow of power from the legislative branch to the executive branch. I mean, the founders set up a system of checks and balances, understanding that each of the branch of government would fight for power, and you'd sort of have this mutual standoff that as they each branch would try to grab power from the other, and through that you'd sort of have this balance. But what has happened over particularly the recent decades is Congress has sort of abdicated its role and handed over more and more power to the executive branch. And of course, Trump is accelerating that immensely. He has repeatedly said that he can do whatever he wants as president. He attacks any institutions that might act as a check on his power, like Congress and the courts and the media. He argues that the laws that constrain every other American don't apply to him, and he abuses those powers that are granted to him, like the pardon power, and as we discussed earlier, the conduct of foreign policy, and you know, emergency powers. Emergency powers, I think, is a great example where Congress has handed over an enormous amount of power to the president through the National Emergencies Act, and then this president really abuses those powers by concocting this emergency on the border to try and build this wall, when Congress has specifically said we're not going to allocate money to the wall. So I think Congress needs to reassert itself and take back some of the power that over the last decades it has slowly handed over to the executive branch.
And Congress, you know, where Trump actually said, I'm going to take this money from the military budget and I'm going to spend it on the wall. And in effect, I know this is illegal and I'm going to need help to do it. And if you help me, I will pardon you. I mean, if that's not an abuse of executive power, there is no abuse of executive power.
That's right. It's illegal and it's unconstitutional. And actually, Protect Democracy is representing El Paso County and others in challenging the president's emergency declaration on the border.
You know, one of the ironies was that the Emergency Act was actually passed by Congress in an attempt to sort of limit the use of presidential power, and they were trying to sort of put some limits on it. They say, well, there might be conditions where a president actually had a real emergency. It wasn't time for, you know, a congressional debate, a senatorial debate with filibusters and everything else that goes on. So we want to recognize that. But let's put some limits on what really is an emergency and to define it. And so there's such a huge irony that now it's become used as a tool to actually make decisions which are not emergencies, even though the initial attempt to define that you could do that occasionally was an attempt to limit it, not to broaden it.
That's right. And Congress now has a real opportunity to amend that act to do what it was originally intended to do, which is to restrain the president from exercising this emergency power. I mean, it is a classic tactic of authoritarians around the world to concoct an emergency to grab power. And I think it would behoove Congress to at least make it harder for that to happen by amending the existing law.
I think that's a good example of what you were talking about earlier when you said, you know, when Trump's gone, we need to begin making some changes. That would be a really good example of something Congress should take up early. They could, and the House, of course, could even begin working on it now. They have the votes to consider what that might look like, so when they actually get power, they could actually enact it.
You know, I this may be one where we don't even need to wait. You know, the Senate voted, including some Republicans, voted to end the emergency on the border that Trump had declared. Unfortunately, that will be vetoed by the president almost certainly. And, you know, I'm not sure there are enough votes to override the veto. But this is one area where there is bipartisan support for reasserting Congress's authority and restraining the president.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, your ink spot on the dial. You may also visit KSQD's homepage and stream the station live to hear this show and the other wonderful programs offered. Check KSQD's website for the program schedule. Listen to past shows on our website's archives section. Please also consider becoming a sponsor of this show or another favorite program. Non-commercial community radio thrives on your financial and listening support.
Coming Sunday, October 6th, it's Squid Fest West, a fabulous concert and silent auction to benefit K-Squid. The event takes place at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz from 4 to 8 p.m. Come celebrate with performances by Keith Greninger, Tammy Brown, the Koffis Brothers, Steve Palazzo, William Coulter, Shelley Phillips, Steve Coulter, Anthony Aria, Dan and Laurel and the Dooners. Silent Auction includes a six-day photo safari to South Africa, art by Annie Glass, Squidware, music memorabilia, and more. Tickets are limited and available now at brownpapertickets.com. That's Squid Fest West, Sunday, October 6th at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. See you there.
Now, back to our guest, Ben Berwick, who worked for the Department of Justice for 6.5 years before joining Protect Democracy, and Mike Rotkin, who before retiring taught for 42 years at the University of California, Santa Cruz Community Service Department. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And Ben, on Protect Democracy's website, it states that the Democracy Threat Index is at 41%, or in the words there, the index label is substantial erosion. To be honest, I would have thought it would have been higher than that. Even President Carter stated back in 2015 that he thought America was no longer a democracy but an oligarchy. Then when one adds that the Republican Party isn't interested in democracy, corporations have been plotting since the 70s to destroy it, and the religious right is steadfastly fighting for theocracy, it seems to me America is more in the next index level, the near-term survival threatened, with these powerful forces combating against it. What are your thoughts about that? Because it seems like we're farther along than 41%.
Yeah, I mean, so that score is generated by sort of a survey that a number of political scientists and others take periodically. So it's an index that sort of tracks their answers over time, and it's not an exact science, but I think it sort of gives you a good sense of where we stand relative to other countries in the world. Let me say one other thing there, Jill, which is I want to really note that Protect Democracy is a nonpartisan organization, and in fact, we have a very bipartisan staff. Many of my colleagues, I am a lifelong Democrat, and I worked for a Democratic administration. I worked for the Obama administration, but many of my colleagues are lifelong Republicans and work for Republican administrations, and this. Our democracy and the institutions that have made it stand up for the centuries that it has traditionally been a bipartisan cause. It has not been broken down on Republican and Democratic line. Republicans have been just as interested in protecting our Constitution as Democrats have. So
traditionally, but what about now?
Traditionally. Well, obviously, you have the president's supporters lining up behind him and his autocratic behavior. But there are a substantial number of Republicans who are really troubled by the president's behavior and who are committed to protecting democracy. I talk to them almost every day.
That's very heartening.
If we're going to fix the problems in the long term, it's got to be done on a bipartisan basis, and it's got to be done by working with all of us who believe in this country and our democracy, and we're free to disagree on policy, but those policy disagreements need to happen in the context of a functioning democracy, and that's really what we need to be focused on right now.
I mean, we have to remember the change in the Republican Party, which really began with the Nixon administration in a dramatic way, really transformed a party that had initially, been, although often representing big business in terms of its economic approaches, on questions like civil rights, a number of kinds of issues earlier on, was not a party that was captured by the right or a party that had no interest in democratic institutions. And it's not an accident that President Eisenhower, as he left office, warned about the military-industrial complex. Republicans had a wide range of different kinds of views, and you had a wing, at least a significant wing of the party, the Rockefeller wing as it was understood at the time, that was quite liberal on social issues and questions of economic issues for people in inner cities and those kinds of questions. So, I mean, it's a long time in the lives of probably many of our listeners, but from my own perspective, and I'm not that old, but I'm 74 years old, I've lived in a country where the Republican Party was open to possible coalitions over certain kinds of issues. You didn't. I mean, I've been a lifelong Democrat as well, but there were the possibility of these kinds of changes, and you saw Republicans taking initiative on important kinds of questions. I think it's been that's something that's been very rapid in terms of the change when they went to the Southern Strategy and decided that they were going to use racism as a basis for their national elections and those kinds of questions. So it's a lot more difficult now to find Republicans who are willing to take these broader stands, but they still exist. Just yesterday or the day before, the governor of Massachusetts came out with a very strong statement about Trump being a traitor, and went beyond anything I would ever say, that the only penalty for being a traitor was death or something. That's like pretty extreme kind of comment, but that's a Republican who's finally had enough. And certainly some of the traditional intellectual thinkers on the Republican Party, George Will, who make these kind of William Sapphire even back earlier, beginning to sort of have some real qualms about where things are going and sort of raising some significant questions about the way things have developed. And those are people I didn't agree with much on policy issues, but they do have a commitment to a bigger vision of a country that has a democratic process still in place.
And, Ben, I completely agree with you that we cannot reunite this country unless we do it on a bipartisan way. How to find that way, maybe you can be more encouraging or help me understand better, because I recently read an article by historian and professor Christopher Browning. It was titled The Suffocation of Democracy. And he said that he thought future historians would look back at these times, that the gravedigger of American democracy would be Mitch McConnell. Interestingly, McConnell probably calls himself a grim reaper, and setting that wacko thinking aside, or warp thinking, McConnell during Obama's term did all he could to make democracy as dysfunctional as he could and diminish the respect of democratic norms by trampling on the precedents concerning appointment to the Supreme Court. And he continues appointing judges from the Federalist Society who appear to hold some contempt for democracy and constitutional government. And McConnell also won't pass any legislation that comes to the floor in the Senate. So wouldn't this lead to one-party rule, which is also an anathema to the democracy? I mean, how do we get to that bipartisan when we have people in a key position like that doing what he's doing with the judgeships, the Supreme Court, and our legislation?
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree that Mitch McConnell bears a lot of the blame for where we are right now and the decline in our democracy. I think my point is that we're not going to get back to where we need to be without working with at least those Republicans who are not completely in the thrall of Donald Trump, right? There is some percentage of the country right now that is probably not going to agree with Protect Democracy on our issues. That's, I don't know, in any given day, it's 30% or 35% of the electorate. But that leaves a large number of Republicans who are extremely troubled by what they're seeing and who are not completely in the pocket of the president, who don't agree with the direction that he's taking this country. And those are the people that we need to speak to and try to understand. We don't need to convince them that we're right on climate change or on civil or on other policies. We're free to continue to disagree on policy, but I think we do see eye to eye on, what we want this country to be and what we want this country to look like and how we want our democracy to function.
Donald Trump can't do what he's been doing without enablers in the legislature, and certainly Mitch McConnell's the chief enabler. But even McConnell had pause over the most recent stuff because he was willing to have the Senate basically subpoena the records from the president. And even he couldn't withstand the embarrassment, I think, ultimately, of like what this looks like, the most recent attempt to sort of buy support for an election money appropriated for other purposes by the U.S. Congress. And so even though he didn't give a great speech about it, but he made the right decision about it. And
So that was
things
helpful.
Things must be getting pretty difficult, when Mitch McConnell is no longer willing to sort of be the front guard of a football team for Donald Trump.
I mean, Jeff Flake, who's a former senator from Arizona, as I'm sure you know, was quoted the other day as saying, if the vote were anonymous, 35 Republican senators would vote to convict after impeachment. In other words, to kick this president out of office.
If it were anonymous.
It doesn't speak well of where we are in this country that if it were anonymous. I mean, I wish more of those members would take their duty to the American people and to the Constitution seriously enough to do what they obviously know is the right thing. But at least we know, if Jeff Flake is right, that they recognize that we're going down the wrong road here.
This is hopeful. You're talking about Republicans not being in Trump's thrall, but this whole concept of the Republican Party being a one-party, one-rule party was started way back with Newt Gingrich. I mean, it's been a focus for a long time to own the libs, to own the party. And so that, when you were talking at the very beginning about there's more underlying issues than just Donald Trump, I think that's one of them, because there are quite a few that want the party to be in control. And there's also, this also leads to the corporate elites, the money that's in politics, and that really one party seems to be focused on giving tax breaks to that corporate elite, that ruling elite, than the other. You have thoughts about that, Ben?
Well, I think there's plenty of room to disagree on, economic policy. I certainly, tend to disagree with the Republican orthodoxy on economic policy. But I think there's plenty of room for legitimate disagreement there. I think you are right that we are in a bad situation where one party views the other party as, in some ways, illegitimate. That is, through most of our history, the Republican and Democratic parties have disagreed on policy, but have understood that each has a legitimate claim to power and a legitimate right to rule if they win an election. The problem that I think we are in now is that the parties, and I think particularly the Republican Party, sees the other party as illegitimate, is not having the right to rule at all. And if you believe the other side is actually illegitimate, then you can start to justify things like manipulating an election or suppressing voters to come into power, because that is better than having the other side come into power. And that is the cycle we have to break out of here. We have to understand that the parties may disagree on policy, but each party has a legitimate claim to convince voters that their policies are the better policy, and allow the voters to decide. And now I, as a Democrat, am confident that if voters are allowed to decide, they will more often than not elect Democrats. But I'm willing to take the chance that I'm wrong about that, and that voters prefer Republican policies.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. I'm your host, Jill Cody, and we've been speaking with Ben Berwick, Protect Democracy's counsel, and Mike Rotkin, five-time mayor of the city of Santa Cruz. Immediately following this show is New Dimensions. This week on New Dimensions, a conversation about the transformation of suffering with the Lama Paldin Drolma. She is a psychotherapist and Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. While we desire happiness in all experience, we all experience sorrow, pain, and tragedy in our own lives and through what we see and hear in the media. Learn about practices that transform the experience of suffering to cultivate kindness, love, compassion, and wisdom. New Dimensions airs Sunday at 6 p.m. immediately following Be Bold America here at KSQD 90.7 FM, your ink spot on the dial. And we're talking with Mike Ben Berwick and Mike Rotkin. Mike, you wanted to follow up.
I was just thinking about the question of the Republican Party. So one of the issues here is this structural questions and the way our Constitution is established. And the fact that Montana and several other states have two senators when they have a population that's less than San Jose, California. And we have two senators for 40 million people in California. And that's problematic. I'm an optimist, and I think we can overcome that and still manage to have a government that represents the people when 3 million more people voted for Hillary than for Hillary Clinton than for Donald Trump. But it is a serious problem. And when the Supreme Court has determined that they have the Supreme Court, the court system, the judicial system has no interest in the question of gerrymandering. It's like that's a state problem. We don't care about it. You can do whatever you want. Basically abandoning the concept of one person, one vote. There's a structural problem that sort of gives the Republicans at this point a kind of an edge that's going to make it, I think we'll overcome it, but I think it's going to be very difficult to do so. I wonder what your thoughts are, Ben, about I don't see how we're going to ever get people to change the Electoral College, for example, in the way that it's structured, but to what extent are transforming some of those questions, the gerrymandering system, the ability of states to sort of determine like what the districts look like. So you have these safe districts, which that's what's making those senators afraid who might vote for impeachment but would never do so because they're in a very safe Republican district where they feel they'd be voted out of office if they took a principled stand. Do you think we have to challenge those institutions or perhaps have constitutional amendments that address those, or should we just leave those things in place and work around those and get to the other issues? I'm curious what your thoughts are about it.
Yeah, look, we're called Protect Democracy, but we're under no illusion that American democracy is perfect. I think these are questions that we've been struggling with since the founding for centuries. And that is a struggle that I think will continue over the next decades and hopefully centuries. I don't know that we're ever going to get to a place where our democracy is perfect, but that is what we should be working towards, and that is what we should be striving to achieve. And I do think that there will be a time to think about sort of these bigger structural and institutional reforms like the Electoral College, like gerrymandering. I think, my hope is that there is a window to do some of these things as soon as this president is out of office. But I think the immediate task is to really fix some of the vulnerabilities and flaws in our system that this president has exposed. But we are absolutely, as an organization, thinking about sort of those somewhat longer term, bigger reforms to our institutions and the structure of our democracy that will get us towards where I think we really want to be, which is a more perfect democracy than the one that we have right now.
Well, just picking up, too, on something you said, how the Democratic Party is delegitimized, or the Republican Party is trying to delegitimize it. We're not even considered the loyal opposition anymore. You can't be an opposition party without being demonized in some way. And I'm really concerned about us correcting that when we have the drumbeat of Fox News and the takeover of AM radio by the right-wing talk shows that just keep beating that drum that Democrats are fellow Americans, are the other, our enemies. And so I'm worried about how we're going to reunite our country and protect this democracy when we have a media so broad throughout this country that that doesn't want that.
And the president plays a role in delegitimizing the actual mainstream media, which has, again, got lots of problems. And I've, you know, battled against a bunch of the stuff they've done for years. But the reality is, when you have people thinking that they'd rather believe something they got in a little email from somebody than actually they read in any of the mainstream newspapers in America, we have a serious problem on our hands. And the president, to say he encourages it is a gross understatement. He is after them as like enemies of the state. And to attack the media in that way, I mean, again, that's another one of these parallels without going too far with Nazi Germany, with the idea that the actual media of the day, the newspapers and so forth, were attacked as, like, you know, full of lies and misrepresenting things. And so somehow we need to, once again, that's one of your 6 points, I know, is reestablish the commitment to these independent institutions. And the media is kind of a key one of those institutions. And when we think about that media, we're thinking about something other than Fox News and, you know, people's social media takeovers that have been going on in recent years.
Ben?
Yeah. One of the really disturbing things that we've seen is, as you alluded to, the president using the power of his office to threaten the media that he perceives as critical of him. Not just criticizing the media and calling the press the enemy of the people, but actually threatening to use the mechanism of government to punish those who he thinks are on his side, like the Washington Post, like CNN, threatening to punish Amazon, Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, also owns the Washington Post, threatening to interfere in the merger between AT&T and Time Warner because Time Warner owns CNN, which he perceives as critical of him. This use of government power to punish critics is a clear violation of the First Amendment.
And then we should add to that disinviting the correspondence from various mainstream media from press conferences, you know, where people have a right to sort of have them there and report what they perceive the president's saying.
That's exactly right. And we, Protect Democracy, represent PEN America, which is an organization that has as members writers, including members of the media, in a First Amendment lawsuit against the president to try and get courts to say that this is a violation of the First Amendment, as it clearly is, and that the president can't threaten to use the mechanisms of government to punish media that is critical of him. And as you say, you know, fortunately, courts have already twice slapped down this administration and then issued injunctions against this administration for revoking press passes of reporters when the White House viewed that reporter's coverage as too critical.
Right. I mean, that's really pernicious and a serious, serious threat to our democracy.
You know, in the last few minutes, Ben, I wanted to move to what you think our listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. But is there anything else that you wanted to cover with Protect Democracy? Wanted the listeners to also know it's protectdemocracy.org. Is there anything else that you want to share with us about Protect Democracy before we start talking about keep, stop, starts?
And as you said, I would encourage listeners to visit our website, protectdemocracy.org, and read about the work we're doing. And I would also encourage listeners to read more about the 6 red flags of democratic decline that we've discussed a little bit tonight, and really sort of understand those categories of authoritarian action, because I think you will start to see that Trump's behavior really fits into these 6 categories. And I think it's helpful to have a framework to understand that Trump is really operating straight out of this authoritarian playbook.
So one start is to start checking out your website for those 6 areas and start. You know, it's helpful to have some sort of framework to view what's happening, and I think that's very helpful. Mike, do you have any keep, stop, starts?
Well, I will repeat something I said on your last show, which I think is kind of critical. And one of the things we have to keep doing is, I say start with stop, actually. Stop thinking that there's nothing we can do about all of this, it does get discouraging, and people sort of throw their hands up and at some point walk away from it. And we have to stop that kind of attitude. And that means starting an attitude of looking into what's going on, informing yourself, talking to other people about what's happening, and finding that it's not easy, but finding ways that you can actually begin to express your concern about the issues that we've been talking about this evening. And that's what it means to be a citizen. That is patriotic. That's what people need to be doing more of. And so I think that's kind of critical for folks.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to give you some stuff in each category. Keep doing, start doing, and stop
yes,
doing.
Yes, please.
Please do.
Let's
love to hear it.
Everyone should vote. Vote regularly, vote consistently, and vote, you know, not just in national elections, but in state and local elections as well.
Just to jump in for a second, I think I read that the non-voter is the largest population group. Those that don't vote, there are more people that don't vote than do, either in Republican or Democratic. Have you heard that?
That's true. That's not true in presidential elections, but if you look at all elections overall, two elections ago in Los Angeles, 15% of the voters came out to vote for mayor. 15%. You know, get some idea of, like, that's how you end up with an average that's as low as you're talking about.
So back to you, Ben. I just wanted to jump in while you were talking about voting, that the non-voter, we need to get those non-voters engaged. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there is reason to be optimistic. There's reason to be optimistic that our institutions are going to hold and that we're going to withstand this time. We're going to get through it. We're going to survive this assault on our democracy. But it's not going to happen automatically. It's going to happen because people vote, because people make their voices heard, because people push back on this assault on our democracy that we're seeing on a daily basis. So, you know, another thing I'd say to keep doing is to really stay engaged. This is along the lines of what Mike said. Keep paying attention. I know it's exhausting. I know it can be overwhelming. But really, the way we're going to get through this is by individuals paying attention and finding ways to push back. So help others register to vote. Drive people to the polls. Show up in town halls. Write to your representatives. Write to your local newspapers and editorial boards. And you know, where necessary, go out and join marches and protests. One other keep doing, I would say, is, you know, support local journalism and get your information from a variety of sources. Support the media, which this president is attacking.
Mike,
things
did you
that
have,
I would say?
Okay, go ahead, Ben.
No, please, Jill.
Why don't you go to what we should stop doing there, Ben? We haven't got a lot of time left in the program. It'd be good to hear your views about that.
Yeah, so I think stop seeing each episode of Democratic erosion as an isolated incident or an isolated scandal and see it sort of that it fits a broader narrative and a broader framework. Stop getting frustrated and letting it make you disengage. You know, find ways to sustain yourself and work with others. And the last thing I'll say is listen to your friends and neighbors, understand their concerns and look for common ground, but stop trying to persuade other people. Research says that this doesn't work, and what works far better is just really being willing to listen to each other.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you so much. And I wanted to say thank you to Mike as well, our two terrific guests. And I also want to thank Emily Dunham, Be Bold America's program engineer. And also next time on Be Bold America, we'll be speaking with Carl Peterson, a contributing blogger for Medium, Op-Ed News, K-12 Network News, to name a few. Carl has run for office and is a political activist since 1988. We'll be speaking with Carl about his published piece, Losing the Soundbite War, and Professor George Lakoff's communication manual, Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. And another big thank you to Ben Berwick, Protect Democracy, and Mike Rodkin. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM, Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station, and listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for new dimensions. My name is Jill Cody. Keep, stop, start.